In this part of Focus, we'll be talking with a scholar who is well known for having written about African-American religious history and its place in American public life. His name is Eddie Glaude, and he is associate professor in the Department of Religion at Princeton University. He's going to be visiting the campus here of the University of Illinois next week to take part in a conference being sponsored in part by African-American Studies and Research. We were not able to get him into the schedule during the time that he was here, but we did want to take the opportunity to talk with him, and he was good enough to say he would join us this morning on the program from Princeton, where he is. And what we want to do is talk a little bit about some of his work, particularly some of the ideas that you will find in a book that he has authored. The title is Exodus, Religion, Race, and Nation in Early 19th Century Black America. The book was published by the University of Chicago Press in 2000 and was based on his dissertation for his PhD. The book, in short, takes a look at the biblical story of the Exodus and how it was used by Black Americans both to build a sense of nationalism and also how that same story, that very same story, energized the Black church in its struggle for liberation. As we talk, you're certainly welcome. People who are listening certainly are welcome to call in, ask questions, make comments. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana. If it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. And actually, even people are listening on the Internet, if you would happen to be doing that, and in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, Professor Glaude, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, glad to be here with you. I'm looking forward to my visit next week.
Well, I'm sure the people here on the campus are as well, and we're glad that you could here be with us in this form, even though we couldn't talk with you in person when you were going to be here next week. In the book, the very first line of the very first chapter of your book about Exodus, you write, "No other story in the Bible has quite captured the imagination of African Americans like that of Exodus." No surprise, really, when you think about what that story is about. Although you make the argument that there are perhaps a couple of different ways of looking at this story, maybe more than a couple, but I'm thinking about the fact that it is, in one sense, it is a religious story. It is about religious faith, and it is about a people and their expectation that their God will come through on a promise. So that is certainly one way of looking at it, and people do. But it's also, in some ways, a political story. Mm-hmm. And it's that second kind of reading that, for your purposes and for purposes of this book, is the thing that you're really more interested in. And maybe I could have you talk a little bit about that, what is the difference, the essential difference between seeing Exodus as something that's about faith as opposed to seeing it that's something that's more about politics?
That's a great question. But before I begin, let me just say that my thoughts and prayers go out to all of the families on the Gulf Coast of the United States. I grew up in Moss Point, Mississippi, which is about 30 miles east of Biloxi. Mm. So my thoughts and prayers go out to all of the families in New Orleans and on the coast of Mississippi and Alabama. And as we have this conversation today about what for some people might be abstract matters, I just wanted to let folks know that these people, my family and other families, are on my mind.
Sure.
It's important to understand that the Exodus story was central to the kind of imagining of America itself, right? When we begin to make this distinction between viewing the story as a kind of religious narrative and the story having political value, when we begin to think about the formation of the colonies, we begin to think of, one trope that constantly shows up, of course, is the kind of fleeing from religious persecution. And so there's this idea that moving from the old world to the new will afford folk the possibility to worship in the way that they freely choose. And part of imagining that journey from old to new on the part of Europeans, not just simply black folk, on the part of Europeans, involved imagining it as a travel from Egypt to Canaan land. So the Exodus story has been central to America's self-fashioning. And African Americans who entered this nation involuntarily, as everyone knows, right, noted an irony in that story, right, that a place that was once imagined as the promised land was in fact Egypt. And so because of the kind of constant circulation of the Exodus narrative in the formation of America itself, the tropes of the story were readily available to folk, immigrants, former slaves and slaves, to kind of imagine themselves in relation to this grand but fragile experiment in democracy. Hmm. Now, that's to say that religious narratives, religious languages have always offered themselves, particularly in the United States, to being tools or languages in political life. That people have used languages such as grace, language as redemptive suffering, you know, these sorts of phrases that have always circulated in our political lives. And the Exodus story, in interesting sorts of ways, has been paramount in terms of being a resource for drawing on political languages to talk about notions of freedom, to talk about notions of justice, to talk about ideas of duty and notions of the right, or notions of justice broadly understood. And so I think that we need to be just very clear on how central the story has been to America's self-fashioning, how religious stories, generally the Exodus story in particular, offer political languages for folk to engage in debates about their particular circumstances. Yes.
See, this is something that I think is so fascinating, and not to put too fine a point on it, but this idea, as you've outlined, that the story for Americans has always been important. For white Americans, though, they saw America as the promised land, and ironically enough, black Americans, people who were brought here as slaves, this wasn't the promised land, this was Egypt, and the rulers were Pharaoh in all senses of the metaphorical and otherwise, and to have those two groups of Americans, essentially European Americans and black Americans, latch onto the same story and find meaning in it, but for two very different ways, I find that really fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, it just shows you the way in which language works, right? I mean, it's multiple meanings, the signs fix in sometimes arbitrary ways. So there's a sense in which the story, the Exodus story, is broad enough to capture a number of different political orientations, from folk arguing for freedom to folk justifying repression to folks justifying conquering other lands in the name of God. So the story is broad enough to capture a range of political orientations, aims, and ambitions. And so it's not surprising that you can find in one particular space two different groups reading the same story but finding different points of entry and different resources to articulate very different aims. One, to justify their continued subordination of another group of folk, and another group of people using that very story to articulate their aspirations for freedom and justice. And that's the beauty of these religious narratives, right? There's no one fixed meaning to say once and for all what the story is about.
Something else that I think is also interesting is that there apparently, for African Americans looking at this story, that also they perhaps had different ways of looking at what the message of the story was, and particularly, I guess I'm thinking of the promise of freedom and what it was that it would take to get that, and whether this was whether in fact you could say that this would be, it was appropriate for this to be a violent struggle, and for those people who said, well, really what this is it's a moral struggle, and should not, and violence is the kind of, it should simply be off the table, and talking about how to get from where they are to where they want to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I mean, what's interesting is that the Exodus story is filled with violence, particularly when we think about the conquering of Canaan. And the conquering of Canaan involves a moral justification. In some ways, according to some interpretations. It's a command of God to go slay the giants. So there's no necessary contradiction between violence and moral comportment to the will of God, at least in these biblical stories, right? I mean, you can redact a story in such a way that you can rid it of all the violence that it involves. But violence is everywhere in this account. But I think it's important to see where the accents lie. You know, what parts of the story do people find their feet? You know what I mean? And in this instance, what we see is that among African-American interpretations of the Exodus story, and in some ways, when we look at kind of debates among Jewish populations about how we ought to read the story, Midrashic accounts, we see folk making different sorts of claims. And what we see is that what's really important is one's moral comportment to the will of God. How does one treat others? How does one orient oneself to the kind of commitment that one is engaged in with God? How does one live one's life and to reflect that will? So righteousness becomes a key component of a kind of Exodus politics as I'm reading it. Violence is a part of it, but it's not a necessary part of it, right? There's a chapter in the book where I do a reading of Henry Highland Garnett's 1848 address to the slaves, and he makes the claim that Pharaoh is on both sides of the blood-red waters. In fact, he's trying to get African Americans outside of the Exodus story, precisely because he feels that on a certain reading, black folk were waiting for God to deliver them. To the banks of Jordan and eventually to Canaan. And for Garnett, who was an African-American preacher, he wanted to offer a different language. He was actually trying to encourage slave revolt. But there's a counter politics that could be voiced within the narrative, and it's Exodus politics, which concerns oneself with how one ethically comports oneself with the will of God without recourse to violence. But we need to be mindful, though, that violence is in the story. It's there. We can't clean it up.
I'm sure that people will understand just how important the church has been to for African Americans first in the struggle involving slavery and in the civil rights movement. Was that an institution that simply was uniquely positioned to do that right from the very beginning? I guess I'm just wondering about the resonance with this particular story, whether that helped to establish a kind of a leadership position for the church and for people of faith, or whether in fact that was there already that in fact maybe the story helped to give some structure to that, but that institution was there and was ready to take on that position of leadership.
Well, I could imagine prior to the formation of black congregations and eventually independent black congregations, there were individuals who exhibited extraordinary leadership capabilities and offered extraordinary visions to folk. As they themselves imagined freedom, and imagined freedom perhaps in non-religious or secular terms or non-Christian terms, to be even more specific. But what the church, and we use that as a heuristic, right? It's a shorthand for a number of different expressions of religious faith. What the black church represents in interesting sorts of ways is the kind of beginning of black civil society, out of which most of the kind of black life emerged. There's this wonderful quote in Du Bois's Souls of Black Folk where he says, the black church predates the black family, right? There's this institution that provided an occasion for black folk to gather, to reflect on their relationships with God and their relationship with one another without sanction for the most part, although oftentimes it was under a kind of white paternal gaze. So the church provided an arena within which black folk could imagine themselves as self-determining agents. The church also, in interesting sorts of ways, provided black folk with the language to imagine themselves as free. Self-determining agents is, of course, a secular kind of way of formulating it, but they saw themselves more as children of God And so they were beholden to the master with a capital M as opposed to the master small m. And by seeing themselves as children of God, for whom, who, and God, of course, is a respecter of no persons, in some significant way, the church provided them with languages to short circuit the logic informing slavery, that the slave was just simply a means to the master's ends. You know what I mean? And so by seeing themselves as children, understanding themselves as children of God, they put in place the conditions for the possibility for them to imagine themselves apart from slavery, apart from the constraints imposed by slave masters. That's no guarantee that it resulted in progressive politics. We don't want to make that we don't want to make that error to say by virtue of believing themselves or understanding themselves as children of God, it necessarily created a radical politics. No, that's not necessarily the case. But it certainly put in place the conditions for the possibility for black folk to resist structures of domination that define their lives up to that point. Hmm.
Something else that you deal with is the idea of black nationalism, mm-hmm. and how this story also helps to lay a foundation for that.
Absolutely.
And perhaps you can talk about that as well, and what sort of directions that goes in, particularly, I guess, whether folk at the time were thinking about the possibility of black Americans truly being black Americans and somehow part of that nation, or whether there was the idea that, in fact, that such a thing wasn't really
Absolutely.
Possible.
It's one of the controversial claims of the book. Right, that I try to make the argument that in some ways this story offered up ways to imagine black solidarity that constitute an interesting source of ways, the kind of common sense foundation for any kind of nationalist politics. And it proceeds on the assumption that it's strange that most folk hold the view that black nationalism ought to be a minority position among African Americans in the United States, when in fact, given how we entered the modern world as somebody else's belongings, it would seem that the kind of discourse of communal solidarity would actually have been in the foreground, that it would constitute the common sense of most black folk, that they would be at least at minimum skeptical, at a minimal level, skeptical of the moral capacity of white folk to treat them rightly. And that's not a kind of racist judgment, that's a reasonable and intelligent conclusion, right? When you have folk who hold you as slaves, who treat you as property, who later treat you as second-class citizens, one could make a reasonable judgment to question their moral capacity. And black folk did. And also, it served as a basis for imagining themselves in communion with other similarly situated selves, that is, a basis for imagining a form of solidarity. So when we talk about the Exodus story offering black folk a language to imagine themselves as a national community, you know, it's Pharaoh who first calls the Israelites a people, right? Mm-hmm. It's the treatment of Pharaoh. The Egyptians' oppression of the Israelites that results in the Israelites seeing themselves in interesting sorts of ways as a people. At the moment in which they enter into the covenant, they then enter into a choice. They make a choice to become self-determining agents irrespective of Pharaoh's gaze. So it's this moment of oppression, this moment in which we're all thrown into this kind of cauldron of oppressive practices that enable me to say to my fellow, you're catching a similar kind of hell, we ought to stand together. And it's that kind of initial moment, that kind of baseline solidarity, which is at the root of all black nationalist politics. And so, but there's another move I want to make, David, that I really want to insist. What I'm trying to do is to say that black nationalist ideologues of today don't have a monopoly on solidarity talk. That solidarity talk is at the root of black politics. You see it in King, right? You see it in Garvey. You see it in A. Philip Randolph, right? In a variety of political orientations, there's a kind of assumption that as black folk, we must come together to speak to these practices, to work to alleviate our conditions of living such that we can pursue freedom in a way that's unfettered. and to pursue the possibility of flourishing and to guarantee our children a better life than our own. So what I'm trying to do by making the claim that solidarity talk, right, which is the baseline of any nationalist politics, right, finds its most force, one of its most forceful articulations within this kind of Christian, this appropriation of this Christian narrative, is to diffuse, right, that talk, right, throughout African-American politics, such that certain black nationalists can't claim that they're the only ones who could talk about black solidarity. See, that annoys me. It really does, because they're not the only one talking about it.
We're almost at our midpoint here, I need to introduce the guest, and also one thing that we need to do, because it's the first Tuesday of the month, we're going to do this test of the emergency alert system. So we'll do that, and then we'll continue our conversation with Eddie Glaude. This is a test of the emergency alert system. It's only a test.
Test of the emergency alert system. This system was developed to provide information to the public during emergencies. This was...
And this is AM 580 WILL Urbana. Focus 580 is this program, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. And joining us this morning from Princeton University is Eddie Glaude. He's associate professor in the Department of Religion at Princeton and has written a lot about African-American religious history and its place in American public life. That certainly is the focus of his book, Exodus, Religion, Race, and Nation, an Early 19th Century Black America, published by University of Chicago Press in 2000. As I say, he's talking with us from where he is in Princeton, but he's going to be on the campus of the University of Illinois next week on September 16th. That would be the Friday, to take part in a conference sponsored in part by the African American Studies and Research Program, the African American Cultural Program, the Career Center, and the School of Business. So that's going on next week, and we were not able to have him on the program when he was here physically in Champaign-Urbana, but he was good enough to give us some of his time this way. And we're glad to have this high quality connection here, because indeed it may sound like he's here with me, but he's in Princeton. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 for folks here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here, someone listening here in Champaign County where we are. So we'll bring them in, going first to line number one.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't able to listen as closely as I'd like to, being distracted and all, but I would like to know if you treated, or if you could expand on, if you already touched upon the idea that Christianity was part of the ideology of oppression. The story that was being told was to explain the situation of African Americans on this continent, and that by taking the message, sort of retelling it, breaking it away from the standard lore, that I was wondering whether you looked into first the kind of things that were being said to keep people down, and how you treated the paradigm shift, or whatever you'd like to call it. Mm-hmm. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay.
I think that's a wonderful question. I mean, it's a long-standing question about whether or not Christianity and African-American conversion to it just simply solidified their oppression, right? That is to say, just one justificatory tool among many for the institution of slavery. But there's an interesting dimension to the form of Christianity that the majority of African-Americans embraced. And it has something to do with the importance of the conversion experience, right? When we think about the majority of African-Americans converted to Christianity, slaves at least, during the Second Great Awakenings. And here we have an emphasis on a kind of personal experience of God. So the conversion experience, right, had something to do with one feeling the kind of intimate relation, a feeling of intimate relation with God. And there's a sense in which the slave master or those who in power who were proselytizing among the slaves had to make a choice in some significant way. Do we want the slaves to be mere parrots of the tradition, just simply being able to cite certain kinds of verses, to participate in certain kinds of liturgies or whatnot? Or do we want them to truly understand the faith? And the moment in which we begin to see that the conversion experience combined with this effort to understand truly what Christianity involved, then African Americans were able to kind of make it their own, right? These folk didn't come to the United States with no resources, with no interpretive abilities. So basically what we see, at least according to my colleague Al Rabbitoh in his book Slave Religion, is that African Americans forged Christianity into something distinctive, such that African American Christianity, right, and the adjective African American actually matters. There's a wonderful quotation by the theologian Howard Thurman that the slave dared to redeem the religion profaned in its midst, right? And he did so, and she did so, by really reinterpreting it in light of his or her own condition. So even though Christianity was certainly used to justify slavery, we cannot assume that those slaves who embraced Christianity simply did so because they were automatons. No, they actually embraced it and made it something different and specific to their condition. That's a long-winded answer, but I hope I got at it.
Very good. Let's talk with the next person. This is someone in Champaign, and it's line number two.
Hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, congratulations, I think, on a particularly timely topic. In my opinion, I think the current humanitarian crisis on the Gulf Coast is not intelligible unless one goes into the colonial relations and one starts to see those contradictions. But more specifically, I want to ask your guest, in his analysis of the institution of slavery, and maybe here I'm wanting to rake up an old hoary chestnut on race and class, but clearly that was not a uniform institution. And it was differentiated with house slaves and plantation slaves and so forth. So his commentary on the issue of black nationalism, I wonder if you could speak a bit more on that genesis and its limits in relation to the idea of slavery as a way of production. In other words, in terms of the race and class. So I'll hang up, and I hope I'm clear enough for him to talk specifically about, you know, the institution of slavery as including both racial and economic or class contradictions. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, can you talk to?
Well, I think it's certainly what I'm particularly talking about when I talk about these the appropriation of the religious stories is to kind of talk about the ways in which these slaves drew on languages to forge itself in the midst of a certain economic relation aimed at producing extraordinary excess capital, right? I mean, there's a sense in which we cannot kind of fall into the trap of either-or thinking that whether or not it was fundamentally a racialized slavery, whether or not it was principally economically driven. It was obviously a combination of both. Part of what we need to see is that as black women's wombs were sites for capital accumulation, as black folks' labor became sources for building this great and fragile experiment in democracy, ironically, we see that the discourse of race played a crucial role in justifying their subordination. And what we find in the appropriation of these stories, right, is in some ways an attentiveness to that language, to that justification, to that ideology of race aimed at justifying the continued subordination and exploitation of black folk. So we don't want to lose sight of the important economic dimensions of the institution of slavery and its aftermath. I mean, in fact, I want to make the claim that it's central. But I also want to make the claim that race overdetermines this experience. It's one thing to be poor in the United States, and here I'm going to be a little bit anachronistic, and really I have the New Orleans situation in mind and the Gulf Coast situation. It's one thing to just be poor, but it's another thing to be black and poor in this country. And race, to such an extent as Stuart Hall would argue, overdetermines class in the United States. Class is the modality through which, or let me say it differently, race is the modality through which class is experienced in the United States. And it's precisely being attuned to that complex interrelationship and interpenetration that leads me to give some attention to, not all of my attention to, the various ways African Americans have responded to the history of racial exploitation in the United States. Sometimes it's the singular preoccupation among black nationalists of a certain sort that leads them to downplay the economic dimensions, to overemphasize the racial dimensions, that gets them into certain kinds of trouble. But we know that they're that the black nationalist tradition is much more complicated than just simply cultural nationalists who are just simply paying attention to cultural or racial issues, that you have left nationalists that are really interested in the complex relationship between race and imperialism and then capitalism. All right. That's a long-winded answer again. Sorry.
That's on this program that we like thorough and thoughtful answers. I would never say something like long-winded. No, we like that very much. We have the luxury of having the time to be able to give to guests. So I wouldn't apologize. Let's talk with someone here in Chicago next. Line four. Hello.
Hello. You've brought up so many things, and I didn't initially want to speak about this, but the last comment that you made about race overdetermining class, I'm beginning to think it's a question of caste because of the fact that it is race overdetermining class. And so maybe you could speak about that. But the reason why I called was that the question about conversion to Christianity, it seems to me that because of the fact that one way the masters, quote-unquote, thought that they were controlling the slaves was by condemning them to illiteracy, it's almost inevitable that the Christian terminology would be the expression of any type of African-American movement, because that was the only literature in English that they had access to. And, you know, nowadays, most Christians talk about salvation history, but it seems to me those early slaves understood immediately that the Bible was about salvation history. And when you look at the Negro spirituals, it seems that they were making an analysis about their situation in that new common language, English, using the only literature or analogies that they could make, which was the Bible stories.
I think that's an excellent point. It's certainly the case that when we look at the context, it makes absolute sense that they would, that Christianity would be the principal religious choice made. It certainly makes sense. I think you're also right. I mean, I folk like Stanley Hauerwas need to hear your comment about the importance of these early black Christians, right? Many of these neo-Orthodox Christian folk looking to the early Christians to articulate some authentic conception of Christianity, often looked past those black slaves who suffered and died, who were martyred in the name of Christ, as they looked past them as exemplars of the kind of Christian faith that they're putting forth. So I think you're absolutely right in that regard. There is something distinct and unique about the sound of Christianity that comes out of American slavery. There's a pathos that speaks of the cross that is profoundly important for any Christian who really seeks to understand a particular dimension of the gospel. So I concur absolutely with your point. And I also want to say to your point about caste that, you know, Oliver Cox wrote a wonderful book, Race, Caste, and Class, a while back, speaking to this issue. It is certainly the case that when we begin to look at how stratified American society is, when we begin to see, as Christoph talked about in his editorial today in the New York Times, that a child in China has a better chance of living than a child in Washington, D.C., we know that the United States has never, in any interesting way, demonstrated a concern for its poor, its rejected, and its despised. And insofar as we've witnessed over the last, not to get too political here, but as we've witnessed over the last few years, the transfer of wealth from the have-nots to the haves, And we witnessed just recently the kind of amazing insensitivity to poor people stuck where the marginal, the invisible, were made visible, swept into our sight by winds of a natural disaster, that this country has a fundamental issue with regards to wealth disparity, with regards to class contradictions vis-a-vis its own voice democratic aims and ends. And that goes all the way back to the founding. I always like to tell my students at Princeton that the serpent of slavery was wrapped around the legs of the table upon which the Declaration of Independence was signed. Okay. That the United States has always struggled with its articulation of its commitments to democratic aims and ends and its simultaneous commitment to undemocratic practices. We've never been in an ideal state where one hasn't been around.
If I could make one more comment.
Sure.
I think it's interesting, when the Holocaust Museum was opened up, someone made a comment that how unusual it is that we don't have a museum to slavery, when that is so fundamental to the history of the United States and its economic success. And I think that goes back to we almost don't know ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
The only historian I know who's ever made an attempt, and he was on the Afternoon Magazine not too long ago, Gary Nash wrote that book, What Was It, Red, White, and Black.
Absolutely.
And he's one of the only historian that I know, and if you know more, please mention them, who tried to integrate the history of the United States, including the conquered, the brought-ins, and everyone, and tried to make an understanding. And I think that not knowing ourselves, it seems that we just keep bumbling into the same mistakes and not able really to treat anything because I don't know what to call it. Mm-hmm. It's willful blindness, I think.
Absolutely.
But I think at the fundamental bottom line is that we don't know our own history because we've refused to integrate, not just in a physical manner, but we have refused to integrate intellectually.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the interesting things about the Exodus story, broadly understood, is that America imagined itself as a chosen nation, as the shining city on the hill. That particular religious imagining of America in some ways snatched it out of history in its own view. Right? Here's a place. We weren't beholden to a feudal past. Our perspective is primarily forward-looking. We viewed ourselves as a shining city on the hill, as a beacon light to the rest of the world. And part and parcel of that kind of self-understanding, I believe, what's inherent to that self-understanding is a kind of naive belief in our own innocence. James Baldwin used to say, it's the damn innocence that gets on my nerves so much.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's the perceived innocence that America somehow, because we believe ourselves to be the shining city on the hill, that we can't seem to come to terms with our inherent contradictions. Right? Martin Luther King used to talk about racism as America's original sin, right? But what we see is that it's not just simply racism. It has everything to do with these undemocratic practices at the very heart of what it means to seek to be a democratic nation. And until we tell ourselves a better story, a story about ourselves that includes our shortcomings, our faults, right, our limitations, that which constrains our aims and desires to be a truly democratic nation, we will always be subjected to, right, elites robbing the coffers of the public coffers in the name of security, elites, right, duping the American public in the name of their own efforts to kind of secure their own individual aims and ends. And until we tell a broader story, a better story, we will continue to have such bad options when it comes to how we understand ourselves and our nation.
Well, thank you, and thank you, Mr. Inge, for once again just having an excellent guest.
Well,
thank you.
Glad you think so. About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and I should introduce again our guest, Eddie Glaude. He's a professor in the Department of Religion at Princeton, has written a lot about African-American religious history and its place in American public life. And if you're interested in looking at this in some greater depth, you might look for his book, Exodus, Religion, Race, and Nation in Early 19th Century Black America, published by the University of Chicago Press. Came out in 2000. We have someone else here, back here local in Champaign-Urbana, in Urbana, line number one. Right here.
Yes. Hi, how are you today?
Good.
In reference to, I would agree in this country, it's usually a racial component, and that has become an economic component for, you know, alienating or repressing people that way. But in the historical sense, when the Europeans first came to the Americas, there in Catholicism, I think there was a large argument as to whether the indigenous people had, you know, souls or not. And then they sort of solved that, and I'm quite sure they debated that issue, too, when they brought slaves over here from Africa. But when you were speaking of how people in the early, I would say in the 17th century, 18th century, when the slaves were, when these churches were developed, as you said, the church before the family. Mm-hmm. Now, if my recollection of reading American history was slaves were not, it was illegal, I don't know if it's in the 18th century or early 19th century, where it's illegal to teach slaves to read. So were they then... How were these stories purely oral then?
For the most part, many of them were oral.
Yeah.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I want to interject another thing, because that, in a sense, places it in the context of Catholicism prior to Protestantism, before the vernacular, you know, text in the Bible. So in a sense, you could sort of do a parallel there. But I just want to know what your opinion on that was. So.
Well, I mean, one of the things that we see, really, mm-hmm. when we look at the Society for the Propagation of the Gospels and their attempt to kind of proselytize among the slaves, mm-hmm. they had a very difficult time, right?
Yeah. Oh,
primarily
yeah.
because of the difficulty with regards to literacy and with regards to the ability of the slaves to speak English. And so the idea of introducing the slave to you know, teaching them the catechism, right?
Yeah.
Kind of taking them through steps by steps, right? Taking in order for them to be baptized, just simply was not attractive for many of the slaves. And in fact, what they found is that many of the slaves were just simply being duplicitous mm-hmm. in the early stages, that they just simply assented to Christianity with the idea that it would somehow result in better treatment.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
In some places, too, we find that it was so pervasive that, listen at this moment, I mean, this shows you how strange the moment was, and in some ways still is. Slaves are being baptized, and the priest or the preacher would actually ask the slave whether or not he or she was being baptized because they wanted better treatment, or whether or not they truly believed in Christ.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And it's actually odd.
Well, actually, in a way, though, I mean, you can understand their position in that, you know, better treatment meant you didn't starve or you weren't beaten. But I think that's actually a really interesting part of your thesis, because how these people became Christians, you know, the theory is that when you're, even as now, if you will go into church now and you're not a Christian, you become a Christian, you have to, you know, actually accept, believe, or whatever, you know, the nature of Jesus and all this stuff. But in a way, that's interesting, because it comes down to the individual back then, which is lost in history, because these people didn't write, their story was never written, except for people like you who sort of gather, you know, the historical evidence that you can extrapolate from that evidence, you
Absolutely.
Know, certain behaviors. But completely sort of on this subject, but off the subject, the woman before was talking about how there was not a museum to slavery. And one of the callous efforts in this country to sort of define that was Walt Disney Company about 6 years ago wanted to build an antebellum theme park and have slaves in it. I don't know if you remember that or not. You're out in the East Coast. There's a huge argument about that. And there was, these professors of religion and professors of history like you signed, you know, declarations that this is, like, unbelievably insulting to these people. They were, you know, have little, you know, people, not in a historical sense, but in a theme park sense. They were going to have slaves, and they were going to have all the, they wanted to use the dialect of this. And I just want to throw that out as sort of the way Americans think about slavery or don't think about slavery.
Oh, absolutely.
That is, to me, indicative of the, just sort of like, to use a political statement, the George Bushification of this country, where you've got this, you know, you got these people that are like idiots that have some idea of history, which is so maligned from the reality of it. And, of course, they killed the program, but they were going to spend like $3 billion building this park. But I just want to throw that out for that woman in Chicago. Yeah. I really appreciate your work. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
One thing that I would like to have you talk a little bit about, back at the beginning of the program, you talked about the fact that the Exodus story was a very fundamental story that many different Americans had identified with. And the fact that European Americans identified with this story because they saw themselves as the Israelites. They saw the America as the promised land. And that African Americans, people who were brought here as slaves, they didn't see America as the promised land. They saw it as Egypt. But again, they saw themselves as the Israelites. That the ruler, essentially the rulers were Pharaoh. And I'm interested in how that kind of understanding, that identification with the story, was reinterpreted in light of emancipation.
Well, you know, one of the great things about the Exodus story is that it's always subject to reimagining. One of the beautiful things about the Exodus story, particularly as it circulates in the Jewish tradition, as I understand it, is that it's constantly being retold. It has to be, right? It's such that people can relive it in interesting sorts of ways. And so what we see is that in the retelling, it's always reimagined. And so we can see the promised land being reimagined, the promised land, you know, being imagined as the North, the promised land being reimagined as as Canada, the promised land being reimagined in a number of different spaces, geographical locations. So post-emancipation, well, what did the Exodus story involve? Well, it had something to do with securing education for a generation of children. It had something to do with beginning to forge, to reunite families, beginning to forge a life outside of the restraints of the plantation system. It also had to do with understanding that Egypt is probably wherever you happen to be. So even though slavery was destroyed, we see sharecropping emerge. Right. We see other forms of oppression. We see Jim and Jane Crow beginning to take shape. We see the violence of extra legal violence with regards to the KKK as they try to police a Southern society or Southern cultural mores that are under threat. And in each of these instances, this story provided language, right, for these folk to imagine, so much so that we even hear Dr. King in his last address imagining himself as Moses. He's been to the mountaintop and he's seen the promised land and he wants to let us know that one day we will reach it, you see? So at this instance, we see each generation, given the particularities of their condition, right, drawing on the tropes of Exodus to imagine the possibility of being free, right? So it's an amazingly, it's an amazing story. Let's just put it that way.
The next caller we have is someone listening in Urbana. We'll talk with them. They're on line one right here. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I just have a comment. I think there is a slave museum in Cincinnati now. It just opened a few months ago. And in southern Illinois, there are some underground railroad homes that or stops that are available, but I can't remember exactly where that is. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Right. Yeah, bye. I know there's the Underground Railroad Museum in Cincinnati. That's amazing. We know that there have been some installations at the Smithsonian with regard. I think more so, I took the caller to be making a more general point, not necessarily about the we could talk about the specifics. But there's a sense in which, has there ever been any kind of fundamental national recognition, right? National recognition of this dimension of our past, such that we're constantly reminded of it, such that we don't fall into the kind of hubris that will lead us to view ourselves as somehow more moral and ethical than some other nation. And I don't think we've ever done that.
Let's try.
I might be wrong.
Maybe one more quickly here. Champagne, line two. Hello.
Hi, good day. I just a follow-up question on the race and class I posed earlier. I just wanted to call your guest, his excellent comments, to comment on the usefulness of this idea of the black nation in relation to inter-class racism. I'm trying to think through, you know, people like Condoleezza Rice and so forth.
Excellent.
And so how useful is this idea now in the reimagining of this Exodus story, this idea of a black nation, in trying to get through these inter-class contradictions through people, you know, like Condoleezza Rice and then the local people
in Louisiana? I'll hang up. Thanks a lot.
I think that's an excellent question. I mean, part of the work that the trope of the Black Nation, part of the work it did was to allow us to mobilize communities of varying sorts to fight and to resist and to struggle against oppression of various sorts. It becomes very difficult when we begin to see various class rifts. Not only class rifts, we see rifts around sexuality. We see Black Christian conservatives who are, I think, who are saying some very hateful things with regards to the questions of gay marriage. So we see these fissures defining Black communities in interesting sorts of ways, such that the appeal to notions of the Black nation or the Black community requires a lot more work. It can't do the kind of mobilizing work it used to. And this is part of our challenge today to reimagine African-American politics in light of the tremendous diversity that defines Black communities today. Until we begin to wrap our minds around this, we will always have trouble dealing with the fact that Black folk are human beings. And if we're human beings, that means we have a range of views, ranging from conservative to progressive. If we're human beings, that means we could do dastardly things, or we could be as graceful and dignified and good as any other human beings. And once we realize this, once we stop begging for freedom and asking people for freedom and just simply be free, we can recognize that there's this vast diversity among Black folk, and then we could begin to articulate a politics that's reflective of the complexity of our own current moment.
Well, there we'll have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. Our guest, Eddie Glaude, is author of the book Exodus, Religion, Race, and Nation, an Early 19th Century Black America, published by University of Chicago Press. You can look for the book in the library at the bookstore. He's professor in the Department of Religion at Princeton University and will be visiting here at the campus of the University of Illinois next week on Friday, one of a number of speakers taking part in a conference, Avenues for Advancement, sponsored by African American Studies and Research, African American Cultural Program, the Career Center, the School of Business. So you can check into that if that sounds interesting to you. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, and keep up the great work.